Section 13 of The House Without a Key by Earl de Biggers. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Section 13. The Luggage in Room 19. John Quincy emerged from sleep the next morning with a great effort and dragged his watch from under the pillow. 8:30! Good Lord, he was due at the office at 9. A quick bath and shave, a brief pause at the breakfast table, a run past the public gardens and the common, and down to School Street. He sat up in bed. Why was he imprisoned under mosquito netting? What was the meaning of the little lizard that sported idly outside the cloth? Oh, yes, Honolulu. He was in Hawaii, and he had never reached his office by 9. It was 5,000 miles away. The low murmur of breakers on the beach confirmed him in this discovery, and stepping to his window, he gazed out at the calm, sparkling morning. Yes, he was in Honolulu, entangled in a murder mystery, consorting with Chinese detectives and Waikiki widows, following clues. The new day held interesting promise. He must hurry to find what it would bring forth. Haku informed him that his aunt and Barbara had already breakfasted, and set before him a reddish sort of cantaloupe, which was, he explained in answer to the boy's question, a papaya. When he had eaten, John Quincy went out on the lanai. Barbara stood there, staring at the beach. A new Barbara, with the old vivacity, the old joy of living, submerged, a pale girl with sorrow in her eyes. John Quincy put his arm about her shoulder. She was a winter slip, and the family was the family. Again he felt in his heart that flare of anger against the person or persons unknown who had brought this grief upon her. The guilty must pay. Egan or whoever, Braid or Leatherby or chorus girl, pay and pay dearly. He was resolved on that. "My dear girl," he began, "what can I say to you?" "You've said it all without speaking," she answered. "See, John Quincy, this is my beach. When I was only 5 I swam alone to that first float. He was so proud of me. 'It's a lovely spot, Barbara,' he told her. 'I knew you would think so. One of these days we'll swim together out to the reef, and I'll teach you to ride a surfboard. I want your visit to be a happy one.' He shook his head. 'It can't be that,' he said, 'because of you. But because of you I'm mighty glad I came.' She pressed his hand. 'I'm going out to sit by the water. Will you come?' The bamboo curtain parted, and Miss Minerva joined them. "Well, John Quincy," she said sharply, "this is a pretty hour for you to appear. If you're going to rescue me from Lotus Land, you'll have to be immune yourself." He smiled. "Just getting acclimated," he explained. "I'll follow you in a moment, Barbara," he added, and held open the door for her. "I waited up," Miss Minerva began when the girl had gone, "until 11:30. But I'd had very little sleep the night before, and that was my limit. I make no secret of it. I'm very curious to know what happened at the police station." He repeated to her the story told by Mrs. Compton and Leatherby. "I wish I'd been present," she said. "A pretty woman can fool all the men in Christendom. Lies, probably." "Maybe," admitted John Quincy. "But wait a minute. Later on, Chan and I followed up your newspaper clue, and it led us to a startling discovery." "Of course it did," she beamed. "What was it?" "Well," he said, "first of all I met a missionary on the boat. He told her the Reverend Frank Upton's tale of that morning on Appian, and added that news that a man named Thomas McCann Braid was now in Honolulu." She was silent for a time. "So Dan was a blackbirder," she remarked at last. "How charming! Such a pleasant man, too. But then I learned that lesson early in life. The brighter the smile, the darker the past. All this will make delightful reading in the Boston papers, John Quincy." "Oh, they'll never get it," her nephew said. "Don't deceive yourself. Newspapers will go to the ends of the earth for a good murder. I once wrote letters to all the editors in Boston, urging them to print no more details about homicides. It hadn't the slightest effect, though I did get an acknowledgment of my favour from the Herald." John Quincy glanced at his watch. "Perhaps I should go down to the station. Anything in the morning paper? A very hazy interview with Captain Hallett. The police have unearthed important clues and promise early results. You know, the sort of thing they always give out just after a murder." The boy looked at her keenly. "Ah," he said, "then you read newspaper accounts of the kind you tried to suppress." "Certainly I do," snapped his aunt. "There's little enough excitement in my life. But I gladly gave up my port wine because I felt intoxicants were bad for the lower classes, and—" Haku interrupted with the news that John Quincy was wanted on the telephone. When the boy returned to the lanai, there was a brisk air of business about him. "That was Charlie," he announced. "The day's work is about to get under way. They've located Mr. and Mrs. Braid at the Reef and Palm Hotel, and I'm to meet Charlie there in 15 minutes.
"The Reef and Palm," repeated Miss Minerva. "You see, it keeps coming back to Egan. I'd wager a set of Browning against a modern novel that he's the man who did it."
"You'd lose your Browning, and then where would you be when the lecture season started?" laughed John Quincy. "I never knew you to be so stupid before." His face became serious. "By the way, will you explain to Barbara that I can't join her after all?" Miss Minerva nodded. "Go along," she said. "I envy you all this. First time in my life I ever wished I were a man." John Quincy approached the Reef and Palm by way of the beach. The scene was one of bright serenity. A few languid tourists lolled upon the sand. Others, more ambitious, were making picture postcard history about where the surf began. A great white steamer puffed blackly into port. Standing in water up to their necks, a group of Hawaiian women paused in their search for luncheon delicacies to enjoy a moment's gossip. John Quincy passed Arline Compton's cottage and entered the grounds of the Reef and Palm. On the beach not far from the hotel, an elderly Englishwoman sat on a camp stool with an easel and canvas before her. She was seeking to capture something of that exotic scene, vainly seeking for John Quincy, glancing over her shoulder, perceived that her work was terrible. She turned and looked at him, a wary look of protest against his intrusion, and he was sorry she had caught him in the act of smiling at her inept canvas. Chan had not yet arrived at the hotel, and the clerk informed John Quincy that Miss Carlotta had gone to the city. For that interview with her father, no doubt. He hoped that the evidence of the check would bring about Egan's release. It seemed to him that the man was being held on a rather flimsy pretext, anyhow. He sat down on the lanai at the side, where he could see both the path that led in from the street and the restless waters of the Pacific. On the beach nearby, a man in a purple bathing suit reclined dejectedly, and John Quincy smiled in recollection. Mr. Saladin, along with his tragedy, peering out at the waters that had robbed him, waiting, no doubt, for the tide to yield up its loot. Some 15 or 20 minutes passed, and then John Quincy heard voices in the garden. He saw that Hallett and Chan were coming up the walk, and went to meet them at the front door. "Splendid morning," said Chan. "Nice day to set out on new path leading inevitably to important discovery." John Quincy accompanied them to the desk. The Japanese clerk regarded them with sullen unfriendliness. He had not forgotten the events of the day before. Information had to be dragged from him bit by bit. Yes, there was a Mr. and Mrs. Braid stopping there. They arrived on Saturday on the steamship Sonoma. Mr. Braid was not about at the moment. Mrs. Braid was on the beach painting pretty pictures. "Good," said Hallett. "I'll have a look around their room before I question him. Take us there." The clerk hesitated. "Boy," he called. It was only a bluff. The Reef and Palm had no bellboys. Finally, with an air of injured dignity, he led the way down a long corridor on the same floor as the office and unlocked the door of 19, the last room on the right. Hallett strode in and went to the window. "Here, wait a minute," he called to the clerk. He pointed to the elderly woman painting on the beach. "That Mrs. Braid?" "Yes," hissed the clerk. "All right. Go along." The clerk went out. "Mr. Winterslip, I'll ask you to sit in the window and keep an eye on the lady. If she starts to come in, let me know.
He stared eagerly about the poorly furnished bedroom. "Now, Mr. Braid, I wonder what you've got." John Quincy took the post assigned to him, feeling decidedly uncomfortable. This didn't seem quite honorable to him. However, he probably wouldn't be called upon to do any searching himself, and if policemen were forced to do disagreeable things, well, they should have thought of that before they became policemen. Not that either Hallett or Chan appeared to be embarrassed by the task before them. There was a great deal of luggage in the room, English luggage, which is usually large and impressive. John Quincy noted a trunk, two enormous bags, and a smaller case. All were plastered with labels of the Sonoma, and beneath were the worn fragments of earlier labels telling a broken story of other ships and far hotels. Hallett and Chan were old hands at this game. They went through Braid's trunk rapidly and thoroughly, but without finding anything of note. The captain turned his attention to the small travelling case. With every evidence of delight he drew forth the packet of letters and sat down with them at a table. John Quincy was shocked. Reading other people's mail was, in his eyes, something that simply wasn't done. It was done by Hallett, however. In a moment the captain spoke. "Seems to have been in the British Civil Service in Calcutta, but is resigned," he announced to Chan. "Here's a letter from his superior in London referring to Braid's 36 years on the job, and saying he's sorry to lose him." Hallett took up another letter. His face brightened as he read. "Say, this is more like it." He handed the typewritten page to Chan. Chan looked at it, and his eyes sparkled. "Most interesting," he cried, and turned it over to John Quincy. The boy hesitated. The standards of a lifetime are not easily abandoned. But the others had read it first, so he put aside his scruples. The letter was several months old, and was addressed to Braid in Calcutta. "Dear sir, in reply to your inquiry of the 6th instant, would say that Mr. Daniel Winterslip is alive and is a resident of this city. His address is 3947 Callier Road, Waikiki, Honolulu, T.H. The signature was that of the British consul at Honolulu. John Quincy returned the epistle to Hallett, who put it in his pocket. At that instant Chan, who had been exploring one of the larger bags, emitted a little grunt of satisfaction. "What is it, Charlie?" Hallett asked. Chan set out on the table before his chief a small tin box and removed the lid. It was filled with cigarettes. "Corsican brand," he announced cheerfully. "Good," said Hallett. "It begins to look as though Mr. Thomas Macan Braid would have a lot to explain." They continued their searches, while John Quincy sat silent by the window. Presently Carlotta Egan appeared outside. She walked slowly to a chair on the lanai and sat down. For a moment she stared at the breakers. Then she began to weep. John Quincy turned uncomfortably away. It came to him that here in this so-called paradise sorrow was altogether too rampant. The only girls he knew were given to frequent tears, and not without reason. "If you'll excuse me," he said. Hallett and Chan, searching avidly, made no reply, and climbing over the sill he stepped onto the lanai. The girl looked up as he approached. "Oh," she said, "I thought I was alone." "You'd like to be, perhaps," he answered, "but it might help if you told me what has happened. Did you speak to your father about the check?" She nodded. "Yes, I showed it to him." "And what do you think he did?" "He snatched it out of my hand and tore it into 100 pieces. He gave me the pieces to throw away, and he said I was never to mention it to a soul." "I don't understand that," frowned John Quincy. "Neither do I. He was simply furious, not like himself at all, and when I told him you knew about it, he lost his temper again. But you can rely on me. I shan't tell anyone." "I know that, but of course Father wasn't so sure of you as I am. Poor Dad, he's having a horrible time of it. They don't give him a moment's rest, keep after him constantly, trying to make him tell. But all the policemen in the world couldn't... Oh, poor Dad!" She was weeping again, and John Quincy felt toward her as he had felt toward Barbara. He wanted to put his arm about her, just by way of comfort and cheer. But alas, Carlotta Maria Egan was not a Winterslip. Now, he said, that won't do a bit of good. She looked up at him through her tears. Won't it? I don't know. It seems to help a little, but... She dried her eyes. I really haven't time for it now. I must go and see about lunch. She rose, and John Quincy walked with her along the balcony. I wouldn't worry if I were you, he said. The police are on an entirely new trail this morning. Really? She answered eagerly. Yes, there's a man named Braid stopping at your hotel. You know him, I suppose. She shook her head. No, I don't. What? Why, he's a guest here. He was, but he isn't here now. Wait a minute. John Quincy laid his hand on her arm, and they stopped. This is interesting. Braid's gone, you say? Yes. I understand from the clerk that Mr. and Mrs. Braid arrived here last Saturday, but early Tuesday morning, before my boat got in, Mr. Braid disappeared, and he hasn't been since. Mr. Braid gets better all the time, John Quincy said. Hallett and Channer in his room now, and they've unearthed some rather intriguing facts. You'd better go in and tell Hallett what you've just told me. They entered the lobby by a side door. As they did so, a slim young Hawaiian boy was coming in through the big door at the front. Something in his manner caught the attention of John Quincy, and he stopped. At that instant a purple bathing suit slipped by him, and Mr. Saladin also approached the desk. Carlotta Egan went on down the corridor toward room 19, but John Quincy remained in the lobby. The Hawaiian boy moved rather diffidently toward the clerk. "Excuse me, please," he said. "I come to see Mr. Braid. Mr. Thomas Braid." "Mr. Braid not here," replied the clerk. "Then I will wait till he comes." The clerk frowned. "No good. Mr. Braid not in Honolulu now." "Not in Honolulu?" The Hawaiian seemed startled by the news. "Mrs. Braid outside on the beach," continued the clerk. "Oh, then Mr. Braid returns," said the boy with evident relief. "I call again." He turned away, moving rapidly now. The clerk addressed Mr. Saladin, who was hovering near the cigar case. "Yes, sir, please." "Cigarettes," said the bereft Mr. Saladin. The clerk evidently knew the brand desired and handed over a box. "Just put it on my bill," said Saladin. He stood for a moment staring after the Hawaiian, who was disappearing through the front door. As he swung round, his eyes encountered those of John Quincy. He looked quickly away and hurried out. The two policemen and the girl entered the corridor. "Well, Mr. Winterslip," said Hallett, "the bird has flown." "So I understand," John Quincy answered. "But we'll find him," continued Hallett. "I'll go over these islands with a dragnet. First of all, I want to talk with his wife." He turned to Carlotta Egan. "Get her in here," he ordered. The girl looked at him. "Please," he added. She motioned to the clerk, who went out the door. "By the way," remarked John Quincy, "someone was just here asking for Braid." "What's that?" Hallett was interested. "A young Hawaiian, about 20, I should say, tall and slim. If you go to the door, you may catch a glimpse of him." Hallett hurried over and glanced out into the garden. In a second he returned. "Hm," he said. "I know him. Did he say he'd come again?" "He did." Hallett considered. "I've changed my mind," he announced. "I won't question Mrs. Braid after all. For the present, I don't want her to know we're looking for her husband. I'll trust you to fix that up with your clerk," he added to the girl. She nodded. "Luckily, we left things as we found them in 19, he went on. "Unless she misses that letter and the cigarettes, which isn't likely, we're all right. Now, Miss Egan, we three will go into your father's office there behind the desk and leave the door open. When Mrs. Braid comes in, I want you to question her about her husband's absence. Get all you can out of her. I'll be listening." "I understand," the girl said. Hallett, Chan, and John Quincy went into Jim Egan's sanctum. "You found nothing else in the room?" the latter inquired of the Chinese man. Chan shook his head. "Even so, fates are in smiling mood. What we have now are plentiful." "Shh!" warned Hallett. "Mrs. Braid, a young man was just here inquiring for your husband." It was Carlotta Eggen's voice.
"Really?"
The accent was unmistakably British. "He wanted to know where he could find him." "We couldn't say."
"No, of course not."
"Your husband has left town, Mrs. Braid?"
"Yes, I fancy he has. You know when he will return, perhaps?"
"I really couldn't say."
"Is the mail in?"
"Not yet. We expect it about 1.
"Thank you so much."
"Go to the door," Hallett directed John Quincy. "She's gone to her room," announced the boy. The three of them emerged from Egan's office.
"Oh, Captain," said the girl, "I'm afraid I wasn't very successful."
"That's all right," replied Hallett. "I didn't think you would be." The clerk was again at his post behind the desk. Hallett turned to him.
"Look here," he said. "I understand someone was here a minute ago asking for Braid. It was Dick Kohler, wasn't it?"
"Yes," answered the clerk.
"Had he been here before to see Braid?"
"Yes, Sunday night. Mr. Braid and him have long talk on the beach."
Hallett nodded grimly.
"Come on, Charlie," he said. "We've got our work cut out for us. Wherever Braid is, we must find him." John Quincy stepped forward.
"Pardon me, Captain," he remarked, "but if you don't mind, just who is Dick Kohler?"
Hallett hesitated.
"Kohler's father, he's dead now, was a sort of confidential servant to Dan Winterslip. The boy's just plain no good. And, oh yes, he's the grandson of that woman who's over at your place now. Kamaiku. Is that her name?"
End of section 13.